You're listening to event audio from the Brookings Events Podcast, part of the Brookings Podcast Network. For more in-depth analysis and commentary from Brookings scholars and our guests, go to brookings.edu/podcasts or listen via Apple Podcasts, on Spotify, or your favorite podcast app. Don't forget to follow us on Twitter at Policy Podcasts.
Good afternoon. My name is Suzanne Maloney, and I'm Vice President and Director of the Foreign Policy Program at the Brookings Institution. It's my great pleasure to welcome you all today for an online conversation on two of the most urgent challenges facing the next administration. Among the most numerous and varied foreign policy challenges will be the nuclear proliferation and regional security threats posed by Iran and North Korea. The next administration will need to consider how to build international and domestic support for addressing these threats, whether and when to engage these regimes diplomatically, and the balance between pressure and diplomacy in pursuing U.S. policy objectives. If we reflect on the past 4 years, the moments of greatest risk have come as a result of crises involving the two countries that we're here to discuss today. In 2017, North Korean tests of nuclear devices and intercontinental ballistic missiles brought the United States and Pyongyang to the brink of war.
The balance between
earlier this year, just before
U.S. policy objectives. If we reflect on the past 4 years, the moments of
Earlier this year, just before the COVID crisis hit, the United States was once again at a very close point to a military conflict with Iran after a strike that killed the foremost security leader from the Iranian Quds Force, Qasem Soleimani. While neither one of these incidents led to a direct military conflict between the two countries, it demonstrates and underscores the risks involved. And as a result, I think we can all say with some confidence that Iran and North Korea will remain the top of the priority list for whomever is in the White House in 2021. So it's with that spirit that we have asked an esteemed panel to join us to speak to both questions under either outcome of the elections next month. Let me give a brief introduction of our four panelists, all of whom have extensive experience in the U.S. government. And then I'll add a few housekeeping notes before turning it over to the panel to discuss. Let me first welcome Eric Edelman, the Roger Hertog Distinguished Practitioner in Residence at the Philip Merrill Center for Strategic Studies at Johns Hopkins School of Advanced International Studies. Ambassador Edelman retired from the U.S. Foreign Service in 2009 at the rank of career minister, having served in a multitude of senior positions in the Department of State and Defense, as well as the White House. He served as Undersecretary of Defense for Policy from 2005 to 2009, overseeing strategy development with global responsibility for bilateral defense relations, war plans, special operations forces, homeland defense, missile defense, and a host of other issues. He also served as U.S. Ambassador to Finland during the Clinton administration and U.S. Ambassador to Turkey during the Bush administration. Let me also welcome our own colleague, Bob Einhorn, a senior fellow in the Arms Control and Nonproliferation Initiative, part of the Brookings Foreign Policy Center for Security, Strategy, and Technology. Before joining Brookings in May of 2013, Bob served as the U.S. State Department Special Advisor for Nonproliferation and Arms Control, where he played a leading role in the formulation and execution of U.S. policy toward Iran's nuclear program and helped shape the Obama administration's overall approach to nonproliferation and addressed other nuclear security and strategic stability challenges around the world. He played a key role in the development of the 2010 Nuclear Posture Review and served as the head of the U.S. delegation in negotiations with South Korea on a successor civil nuclear agreement. His previous positions include Assistant Secretary of State for Nonproliferation, Deputy Assistant Secretary of State for Political Military Affairs, and member of the State Department's policy planning staff. We'll also be joined by Matt Kronig, a professor of government and foreign service at Georgetown University and the deputy director of the Atlantic Council's Scowcroft Initiative on Security and Strategy. He's the author or editor of 7 books, including one published earlier this year, The Great Return of Great Power Rivalry, Democracy versus Autocracy in the Ancient World to the U.S. and China, as well as a book entitled The Logic of American Nuclear Strategy, published several years ago. Matt also served in several positions in the U.S. government, including the Strategy Office of the Office of Secretary of Defense and the Strategic Assessments Group at the Central Intelligence Council, a Central Intelligence Agency. Let me finish by welcoming my colleague Jung Pak, Senior Fellow and SK Korea Foundation Chair in Korea Studies at Brookings Center for East Asia Policy Studies. She is the author of a monumental book, Becoming Kim Jong-un, A Former CIA Officer's Insights into North Korea's Enigmatic Young Dictator, that was published earlier this year to rave reviews. It is the authoritative book on North Korea under Kim Jong-un, examining Kim's personality, preferences, and policy choices, and the implications for North Korea's internal stability, denuclearization, and global security. Jung has held senior positions in the Central Intelligence Agency and the Office of the Director of National Intelligence, including as Deputy National Intelligence Officer. Prior to her work in national security, Jung taught at Hunter College and served as a Fulbright Scholar in South Korea. So with that distinguished panel to discuss these very important issues, let me just turn to a couple of housekeeping notes. First, outside of their work for Brookings, our scholars occasionally advise political candidates on the issues in accordance with the institution's nonpartisanship policy. That policy can be found on the Brookings website, and all affiliations are disclosed on individual expert pages also found on the Brookings website. Second, I'd like to thank the MacArthur Foundation for their generous support of Brookings' work on nonproliferation challenges, including but not limited to Iran and North Korea. As always, Brookings has an ironclad commitment to research independence, and the views expressed today are solely those of those speakers. One final reminder, we're on the record and streaming live, so please send your questions to the email address events@brookings.edu or using Twitter with the hashtag policy2020. Now let me turn to you, Bob, to start our conversation. And obviously, we're only 2 weeks away from a major election in the United States that will have important implications toward the approach toward either one of these countries for the next 4 years. And I wanted to ask you, given your experience in the Obama administration, how you think former Vice President Biden and the team of national security officials that he is likely to put in place might approach these two urgent diplomatic challenges.
Thank you very much, Suzanne, and thank you to the audience for tuning in. Of course, I can only speculate on what the Biden administration's thinking will be on North Korea and Iran. I have no inside information. North Korea and Iran clearly would be important issues for the Biden administration. But I don't think they would top the Biden administration's list of priorities. Top priority, at least at the start of the administration, would be domestic, the pandemic, the economy, restoring civility, racial justice. In foreign and security policy, top priorities would include regaining the world's respect for the United States, shoring up alliances, rebuilding U.S. credibility, reestablishing U.S. leadership, and on and on. North Korea and Iran would be seen as serious early challenges that must be dealt with. North Korea, because it poses an existing nuclear threat to our East Asian allies and to the U.S. homeland. Iran, because it poses a potential nuclear threat and a current political and security threat to U.S. partners and interests in the Middle East. In dealing with these threats, the Biden administration, like its predecessors, would rely on the traditional tools of pressure and diplomacy, but it would lean more to diplomacy, certainly more than the Trump administration. The Trump administration's maximum pressure campaign did major harm to the North Korean and Iranian economies, but it utterly failed to compel these countries to capitulate to U.S. demands, and it alienated countries whose support was essential to dealing successfully with North Korea and Iran. a Biden administration would pursue negotiated solutions with both regimes, more actively with Iran, because the JCPOA showed that an effective agreement could be reached with Iran, but more cautiously with North Korea. It would pursue negotiations with North Korea more cautiously because the likelihood of success with North Korea would be lower. And the political minefields of dealing with North Korea are even more treacherous than those dealing with Iran. On Iran, the Biden administration, I think, would seek a follow-on nuclear deal that would be based on the JCPOA, extend the expiration dates for its nuclear restrictions, and ensure effective means of deterring and detecting covert nuclear activities. Separately, and not linked to progress in the nuclear negotiations, it would work with U.S. regional partners to push back against Iran's malign regional activities and explore whether understandings could be reached with Iran to reduce regional conflicts and regional instabilities. As a starting point for negotiations on a follow-on deal, former Vice President Biden has said his administration would return to full compliance with the JCPOA if Iran did the same. Turning to North Korea, I think a Biden administration would be reluctant to plunge into early talks with Pyongyang. I believe it would first want to rebuild South Korean and Japanese confidence in U.S. security assurances. And that includes not threatening to reduce U.S. military forces if our allies don't pay enough. A Biden administration would want to work closely with its allies to develop a common diplomatic approach to North Korea, and then to reach out for consultations with other critical countries, including China and Russia. Any positive outcome on North Korea will require the cooperation of China. Carving out an area of cooperation with China in an otherwise increasingly adversarial relationship will be a major challenge for the Biden administration. The Biden administration won't give up the ultimate goal of complete denuclearization of North Korea, but it may be prepared to approach that long-term goal step by step with reciprocal benefits to each party at every stage of the process. Success in negotiations with North Korea is hardly guaranteed. Kim Jong-un is unwilling to give up his nuclear capability altogether, and may even be unwilling to accept meaningful limits on nuclear and missile programs and the intrusive measures, verification measures needed to ensure confidence in compliance. And in that event, if agreement can't be reached with the North, a Biden administration may have no choice but to work with its allies on a long-term strategy of pressure, deterrence, and containment. The Trump administration failed on North Korea and Iran largely for three reasons. First, it acted alone without the support of key countries, even America's closest allies. Second, it did not align ends and means. It generated tremendous economic leverage, but pursued overly ambitious, unachievable negotiating objectives. And third, it underestimated the determination and resilience of countries prepared to pay an enormous price to protect what they regarded as vital interests. And I don't think a Biden administration will make those mistakes. Thank you.
Thanks, Bob. Turning to you, Matt, I wonder if you could give us a sense of how you think a Trump administration 2.0 might either change its approach to a one or both of these countries, and what you would advise President Trump if he is successful in his reelection campaign to do to make some progress on these two issues, where he's invested a lot of his own personal diplomacy, where, as Bob suggested, we've seen an enormous toll from the economic pressure, the maximum pressure strategy that he's applied, but where he has not yet actually achieved the agreements that roll back the nuclear ambitions of either state. What would you advise? What do you think may happen?
Well, thank you, Suzanne, and thanks to Brookings for hosting this discussion. I'd like to start with an overall point and then go into each country and the Trump administration's policy. So the overall point is I think there is actually more bipartisan consensus in a way on these issues than we often realize in our internal debates. I think there is a bipartisan consensus that the nuclear and missile programs of both of these countries are major challenges, and we want to aim toward denuclearization in the case of North Korea and preventing Iran from going nuclear in the case of Iran. And second, I think there's basically a bipartisan consensus on how to handle these challenges, which is pressure and engagement. As long as these countries continue to develop their nuclear and missile programs, we're going to increase the economic, political, military pressure. But if they're willing to come to the table and negotiate, we're willing to discuss releasing that pressure in exchange for limits on their nuclear programs. So the Obama administration policy toward Iran was called pressure and engagement. The Trump administration policy toward North Korea is maximum pressure and engagement. So pretty similar maximum pressure is the policy toward Iran. So I think the real difference is on how hard you lean on the pressure and the engagement tracks. And then when do you stop? When is good enough? And when do you need to keep going? So first on Iran, talking to some senior Trump officials, when they think to a second term, they do see China as the top priority and a place where they can they think they can continue to make progress. But I think they see Iran as an area where, contrary to much of the discussion in Washington, they think the strategy is working and they're optimistic about what can be accomplished in a second term. So they think the strategy has succeeded in hurting Iran's economy, limiting the resources to support malign influence in the region. The regime is under intense pressure, maybe more pressure than at any time since the founding of the Islamic Republic. And so it's really a two-part strategy. The pressure is meant to force Iran to come to the negotiating table, and it hasn't succeeded in that second step yet. I think there's a sense that Iran is waiting out this election and that they're hopeful that they can get a better deal with Biden. So they're not wanting to come to the table now. But in a second Trump term, that they wouldn't be able to resist this pressure for four more years, that they would have to come to the table and discuss some kind of limitations. So I think, some quibbles maybe from me, but I think overall this is the right approach. We have generated enormous leverage, and we should try to exploit that in a second term. On North Korea, the policy was maximum pressure and engagement. And early on, there was a lot of pressure, threats of fire and fury, the toughest ever economic sanctions on North Korea. And I think that did generate the leverage that brought Kim Jong-un to the table at Singapore and Hanoi. But then I think the negotiating an agreement with North Korea proved more difficult than maybe some in the Trump administration expected. I think many of us on the outside were skeptical. And so I think since that engagement track hasn't panned out, then it's become much less of a priority for the Trump administration. It was a top priority early on, including it was the very first national security review that H.R. McMaster finished as national security advisor. And now we don't hear about it as much anymore. It's more of a back burner issue. I think in a second term, my hope is that it would become more of a priority. And I think, we leaned on the pressure track early on. Then we tried the engagement track. That hasn't worked. And so in my view, it's time to lean back on the pressure track and try to increase especially the economic, political, and military pressure to try to get North Korea in a place where maybe it would come back to the table and discuss serious limits. And it is a nuclear armed power. So in the meantime, we do have to put in place a serious deterrence strategy to deal with the threat that exists. So I think I'll end my remarks there and look forward to the discussion with my colleagues.
Thanks so much, Matt. Jung, I'd love to bring you into the conversation specifically to talk a little bit more about how this election is playing out from the eyes of our adversaries. How are the North Koreans looking at the prospects for either another 4 years of the Trump administration and maximum pressure, or the possibilities of some kind of change in approach as a result of an election of a President Biden? How are other allies and partners around the region, particularly in Seoul, thinking about the possibilities and the options? And particularly if you could speak to these questions of how we continue to engage our partners under either one of these scenarios. That's obviously been a key element of the remarks of both Bob and Matt.
Thanks, Suzanne, and thanks to the panel. It's a pleasure to be involved in this program. Let me talk first about the view from Pyongyang. Elections are not a new thing, so this is not a surprise for Pyongyang, as the Kim family has been playing the long game for a long time, and they're well aware of our practices and sometimes better than we do. Kim Jong-un himself has outlasted President Obama, South Korean President Park Geun-hye, and is likely to outlast Presidents Trump and Moon in South Korea. And while diplomacy has been deadlocked since the Hanoi summit in February between President Trump and Kim, the North Korean leader has been continuing weapons development as he defiantly showcased at the 75th anniversary of the Korean Workers' Party on October 10th. What we saw there was a wide range of weapon systems, including what might have been North Korea's biggest ICBM yet, which was probably the new strategic weapon that Kim threatened to unveil back in late December, early January of this year. And we don't know if these weapons work, but Kim is clearly seeking to possess road mobile missiles and solid fuel engines that could be more quickly deployed and more maneuverable to counter U.S. and South Korean missile defenses. The parade and various UN panel of experts reports and analysis of satellite imagery of North Korea's nuclear and missile-related facilities suggest that Kim has not veered away from his strategic goals of diversifying and mass-producing more capable nuclear weapons, even despite three meetings with President Trump. In that parade, Kim, in a speech, said that he would strengthen the war deterrent against the hostile threat posed by outside powers and frame them as defensive in nature. He made no specific references to the US, suggesting that he was keeping his options open on diplomacy or provocation. This is not entirely surprising. Earlier this month, Kim sent President Trump a get well soon message after the president was diagnosed with COVID-19. And in July, his younger sister, Kim Yo-jong, in a rather rambling statement, said Kim and Trump relationship was good. But regardless of the election, and my colleagues Bob and Matt have talked about how the U.S. as the actor, as the agent, triggering action. But I think regardless of the election, Kim is looking at the long view, and that he still has agency in all of this, in framing how the next U.S. administration, whether it's Trump 2.0 or Biden administration, is going to respond. Kim Jong-un, in his New Year's address, in his New Year's comments, told his people to buckle up for a prolonged confrontation with the U.S. This was in January of 2020. His sister back in July said that, quote, even if the U.S. tides itself over the current crisis of the presidential election, we have to anticipate its endless hostile actions against the DPRK. She added that North Korea should not adjust its tactics on the U.S. and our nuclear program depending on the relations with the U.S. president. That is, no matter how good the relationship is between her brother and any U.S. president, especially President Trump, that the strategy is going to be consistent. I think that this view suggests that regardless of the personal relationship, whatever personal relationships that Kim has with this U.S. president or future U.S. president, that the presidency itself and the person of the president is constrained by the national security bureaucracies, as Matt mentioned, who there's a very broad consensus on how to approach North Korea. And that on the sanctions pressure and calling for human rights improvements, and that Pyongyang is not going to change its strategic posture, though we would expect opportunistic tactical moves, whether with the President Trump or President Biden. So what is the likelihood of change in the North Korea posture? So Kim has shown the weapons. This is part of some of the playbook that he goes through, is that he shows the weapons. And the next thing is to threaten to use them. And the final thing is to demonstrate them and to continue to improving on existing capabilities. Precedent suggests that the regime will test a strategic weapon early on in a new administration to lay down the markers for a new president. The regime did this in 2009 with President Obama and did it again with President Trump in 2017. But it's also possible that Kim will do a similar move, perhaps start with a threat, implicit or explicit, with the Trump administration to show, hey, we're still here. And I think what the key factors for what might factor into Kim's decision making on provocation or dialogue is that he feels reasonably assured that he can pivot to diplomacy and that there'll be a welcome reception for that, a receptive environment for a pivot, even as he has demonstrated his weapons, and that he can still continue to be able to pivot and drive the situation on the ground. And I think part of Kim's calculus has to be on how comfortable or uncomfortable he is with his dependence on China. So far, as a result of maximum pressure, as a result of the years of sanctions that have been building up, that China as a trade partner, as a political partner, has grown in recent years as a result. And so right now, trade with South Korea is down to very little. Trade with other countries is down to little. Trade with Russia is, very minuscule. And so that dependence on China grows, even as, especially as during the COVID lockdowns, especially as the sanctions continue to remain in place, and we have the global pandemic that really inhibits North Korea's tourism industry and other money-making ventures. When we look at some of the other allies and how we should be looking at our other allies, the muscle memory of how we focus on alliances and a multilateral approach are still there. This is not a new thing for the United States to be building up and shoring up our ties with South Korea and Japan to make sure that we're all on the same page. On the South Korea side, the ties have been tense. We had some very high level visitors from South Korea come in last week. To talk about a variety of things. And there have been fissures during the Trump administration in terms of, as Bob mentioned, some of the host nation support issues that is still outstanding, when President Trump demanded a 400% increase on host nation support from South Korea, there's been disagreement about how to approach North Korea. South Korea has been very much focused on engagement, on improving economic cooperation, and providing humanitarian aid. So that continues to make ties between South Korea and U.S. a little bit difficult. When we look at some of the polling on how the South Koreans view the U.S. election, some of the South Korean newspapers are talking about the chaos of this election. When we look at polling, the Pew polls indicate, a Pew poll recently said that 17% view President Trump favorably, but a Chicago Council poll found that 90%, and this is reflective of other polls, 90% of South Koreans still support the alliance. So we have a deep reservoir of alliance networks, working level networks, working level relationships, and a deep reservoir of goodwill in the American people and in the South Korean populace for maintaining the alliance. So let me stop there, Suzanne, and turn it back to you.
Thanks so much, Jung. I'd like to turn now to Ambassador Edelman. I think one of the interesting points that Jung just raised was that despite, as Bob suggested earlier, the fact that any new administration, whether it's the Biden administration or a second term of the Trump administration, is necessarily going to be focused inward on domestic priorities, either or both of these countries will may try to force itself onto the agenda early on in a next term. And so one of the key elements of the strategy of the Obama administration and, frankly, the Bush administration before it was a reliance on trying to devise and maintain our relationships with our allies and partners that could help us solve these problems or at least defer the ambitions of both countries through multilateral diplomacy. Do you see any opportunities for reviving the broad-based diplomacy with partners and allies, including those countries that, as Matt and Bob and Jung have all pointed out, where there have been frictions, including China, including Russia? Is there an opportunity for the next president to build on those important relationships and try to fashion some sort of common approach?
Well, thank you, Suzanne. Thank you for inviting me. And it's great to be on such a distinguished panel, including with two former colleagues from government, Matt and Bob. I would say old colleagues, but I don't want to draw attention to Bob's and my advanced age. So let me start by saying that there's no question that U.S. alliances, which have been a strategic advantage for the United States, both in its dealings with the kind of great power adversaries that Matt focuses on in his book and that the national security strategy and national defense strategy focus on, but also on dealing with rogue actors like the DPRK in Iran. I mean, traditionally, our alliances have been, to borrow a phrase from Walter Lippmann, the shield of the Republic. And there's no question that they've suffered grievous damage, I think, not just under the Trump administration, frankly, but going back, into the Bush administration as well. In the Obama administration, I think you don't have to go back that far or dig that deep. If you read President Obama's interviews with Jeffrey Goldberg, there are plenty of, comments critical of our allies and along, in much more polite terms, but very much along some of the same lines as we've seen President Trump use about free riding and not carrying their weight, et cetera. I would say if there is a second Trump administration, it will be very hard, in fact, maybe not possible to fix the damage to America's alliances. I know, for instance, that John Bolton has said both in his book and publicly repeatedly, he worries that in a second Trump term, President Trump might make good on his threat to withdraw from the NATO alliance. Jung has just talked about some of the issues that bedevil the USROK alliance, and I can't imagine those will get better in a second Trump term. With regard to Iran, we already see some of the costs of that damage in the United Nations Security Council and the inability of the United States to get its closest allies to go along with it in extending the conventional arms embargo on Iran that expired on Sunday. And there's every prospect, if there's a second Trump term, although they haven't done it yet, of the administration launching secondary sanctions to impose snapback based on its reading of the legality here, which, as again, as former National Security Advisor John Bolton has pointed out, whether it's legal, whether the legal argument is right or wrong is less important than the fact that the objective of maximum pressure is to isolate Iran, not to end up having the United States be isolated. So what can we do to try and reinvigorate, our alliances? I would say there are several things. First, I think it's very important for the U.S. First of all, if there's a Biden administration, there will be a giant sigh of relief among allies. And I think that provides a certain opportunity for the Biden administration to reset things. There's a danger, by the way, that they will reset things in the wrong way and just, immediately sort of move to a position of agreeing with our allies on both how to deal with North Korea and Iran. I would argue that that is a mistake. The administration needs to figure out its own policy and strategy and then go to the allies to try to line them up rather than going to a kind of least common denominator approach. But I think what's really important is to sort of pull the camera back and open the aperture a little bit and address with the allies what's really at stake in dealing with these two countries. And I would basically say what's at stake is the entire non-proliferation treaty regime that has been arguably, in my view, the greatest achievement of arms control in the 20th and 21st centuries. You know, President Kennedy, after the Cuban Missile Crisis in the spring of 1963, had a very famous comment that he gave at a press conference when he was asked what kept him awake at night in the wake of the missile crisis. What was the thing he was most afraid of? And the thing he said he was afraid of was having 20 or 30 nuclear weapon states by 1970. Now, here we are, you know, 60 years later, and there are only 9 nuclear weapon states. Why is that? Well, that's because of enormous amount of work by people like Bob Einhorn, who have helped make the nuclear nonproliferation regime a relative success. But that's at stake here. I mean, Bob mentioned in his comments that he didn't think the Biden administration would give up on the idea of complete, verifiable, irreversible disarmament with North Korea, even though there are many voices in the academy and the think tank world arguing for just such a course. And I think there's a very simple reason for that, because giving up on it ultimately would be to say you can join the NPT, get the benefits of the NPT, and then walk out of it. And there are enough countries right now looking at this, including the Republic of Korea, where people are talking now openly about an independent South Korean nuclear deterrent. This is something that was discussed in previous Korean governments in the 1970s. So this is not something that's a completely strange subject for them. But in light of the problems in the alliance that have been created by President Trump, is becoming a much more common conversation. It's a bit more sub rosa in Japan, but I assure you it's there. And we certainly see it in hedging behavior in the Middle East dealing with Iran, including in a country I know a little bit about, Turkey, where President Recep Tayyip Erdogan has spoken now publicly about Turkey being entitled ultimately to its own nuclear arsenal as a major player in the international system. So I think we have to underline for our allies the danger that both of these countries represent to the NPT. Bob said in his comments, opening comments correctly, that North Korea is a current threat and Iran is a potential threat. Well, based on the latest IAEA report, Iran's a lot closer to being a real threat than it was in 2019. They now have 10 times the allowed LEU under the JCPOA that they had in 2019. So their timeline for breakout is now about 3.5 months, according to the IAEA. So this is something that's very, you know, near on the horizon. And to Jung's quite apt points about the new ICBM that was demonstrated a couple of weeks ago by North Korea. North Korea is moving very, very aggressively towards a larger, more diverse nuclear arsenal enforced posture, which is going to impose all sorts of dilemmas on the United States, not least the size and scale of its missile defense effort, which was sized basically for a theory of the case that said North Korea is looking for a very, very small nuclear arsenal in order to deter overwhelming U.S. conventional power. But that doesn't seem to be what they're doing. They're pursuing ICBM. Why do you need a bigger ICBM than the Kwasong 15? You could use a bigger ICBM if you were going to put multiple independently retargetable warheads on it, which would create a very, very severe set of dilemmas for U.S. Defense planners. So what I think the United States needs to do is heighten the sense of urgency among its allies, reaffirm unequivocally its alliance commitments to defend its allies, especially including its extended nuclear deterrence commitments, which I think requires moving ahead with the modernization of all three legs of the nuclear triad to make that credible. Bob talked about, and Matt talked about engagement and diplomacy. And obviously, I agree with Matt that there's a bipartisan consensus on the fact that you need both to deal with these challenges. But the art of, you know, of policy is determining what the balance is between the two. I think one of the things that the Obama administration lacked, and I think some members of the Obama administration candidly would admit this, was a credible nuclear option against Iran, which I think made it much more difficult to negotiate an agreement, and in my view, led to the negotiation of an unsatisfactory agreement. So I think you have to make sure you have military options and that your adversaries know that you are developing them and that you're prepared in extremis to use them. That's not because you want to, but because you want to enable the diplomacy to give them an alternate course to seek a solution to these problems. Maximum pressure, in my view, is a tactic. And the Trump administration, in my view, has been guilty of having a tactic, but not a strategy. And it needs to be embedded in a broader strategy. Bob talked about the importance of going after, the regional behavior of Iran. And I agree with that. I think it needs to be dealt with both in negotiation and in strengthening our ties with our allies, including providing some of the things that only we can provide for our allies in the region, which is shared early warning and enabling them with some crucial military capabilities that only the U.S. has to be able to defend themselves, not just from potentially a nuclear Iran, but from Iran's growing conventional ballistic missile force, which is a threat and a challenge in and of itself to Gulf economic and infrastructure, tourist and economic infrastructure targets that would be very, very desirable targets from a point of view of Iran. And then finally, I think we've given up both in the Obama and in the Trump administrations one very important tool for dealing with both of these countries, which is our emphasis on human rights and the promotion of democracy. That is a huge challenge in the North Korean context, but shouldn't be such a great challenge in the Iran context, where Iranians have repeatedly shown over the last several years their discontent with their regime and their desire to replace this regime and seeing it done with. I don't think the United States can accomplish regime change militarily in Iran, nor should it try to. But it can and should try and help and enable Iranians themselves to oppose this regime, because in the end of the day, it's the most likely route for us to get to some kind of agreement to limit Iran's regional ambitions and its nuclear weapons program. Why don't I stop there?
Thanks so much, Ambassador Edelman, in part because what you just spoke to, I think, addressed at least one of the questions that we've had from our audience. And we'll be looking for more questions from all of you, #policy2020 or email events@brookings.edu. Let me turn back to the rest of the panel with another point that I think was implicit in some of your remarks just now, Ambassador Edelman, talking about the Obama administration's approach and why, in fact, the agreement that was negotiated didn't satisfy some within the United States. And that's really the question of bipartisanship. Matt talked about, a general bipartisan consensus around pressure and engagement. And certainly, from my own work on Iran, I know that's true. In the earliest days after the seizure of the U.S. embassy in Tehran, the first crisis group meeting that was held by the Carter administration outlined just such a strategy of pressure and remaining open to diplomatic engagement with the revolutionaries. And that really has been the playbook that every administration has followed with obvious tweaks and differences in style. And we can see something similar, I think, from what everyone has said with respect to North Korea. And yet, on both issues, there has been a fierce bipartisan debate, and at least with respect to Iran, that sense of partisan rancor and deep disagreement with the Obama administration's policy and approach to Iran led to the Trump decision to walk away from the deal. Is it possible to create or rebuild some kind of bipartisan consensus around tactics as well as strategy? And how would we go about doing that? And this is really a question to anyone on the panel who might want to jump in. Bob, I see you ready to take the mic.
Yeah. People have accused the Obama administration, with some justification, of not working hard enough in the JCPOA to get bipartisan support, not to bring in Republicans and so forth. I think there's a certain truth to that, but I think basically President Obama recognized that many Republicans, especially in the Senate, were bound and determined to thwart any Obama initiatives. And that's terribly unfortunate that it's come to that in our polarized political system. The Obama administration, I think, correctly confined the JCPOA to the nuclear issue. It was the most urgent problem. But the administration said that separately, we will take on Iran's malign regional activities. Many people, Republicans and Democrats, felt the Obama administration wasn't strong enough in pushing back against those activities. And I think the absence of any what was considered a credible regional policy was one of the reasons why it didn't have bipartisan support. There was also the question of the sunsets, the expiration of key restrictions after a certain number of years. That's unfortunate. Can bipartisan support be built for a follow-on agreement? I don't know. I think it'll be hard. The Republicans have kind of staked out the JCPOA as, you know, an original sin. And, one of my concerns with Vice President Biden's determination immediately to go back to the JCPOA is that it immediately alienates half of our electorate. And that's a problem. There may be alternatives to doing that. But I think if a Biden administration took the regional Iran threat very seriously and worked with our partners to address it, I think that could help build support for a follow-on nuclear deal. Also, I think that there may be mechanism. I remember, Eric and I are old timers in this business, and I remember I was a member of the U.S. START delegation, back in the 1980s, and we were visited by, it was called, I think, the Senate Arms Control Observers Group, and you had, five Republicans, five Democrats. They sat in with us in the tank in our mission. We discussed strategy. We consulted with them in Washington. They became real experts. I think if there's a Biden administration, it should try to work with the leadership in Congress to establish such a mechanism to try to build bipartisan support. It will be hard. The JCPOA has a partisan history, but I think we can do better next time around.
I agree largely with what Bob just said, but let me add a couple of points, if I could. One is there was some bipartisanship in the Senate in the consideration of the JCPOA, which ultimately was the very reason why the Obama administration decided not to submit it for a vote. Because if you go back and recall, if the Democrats flip the Senate, this year, which I think is highly likely, the incoming Senate Majority Leader, Chuck Schumer, announced himself against the JCPOA, said he'd vote against it. The incoming chairman of the Foreign Relations Committee, Bob Menendez, said he would vote against it. The next ranking Democrat on the committee, Ben Cardin, said he would vote against it. So there was actually quite a bit of Democratic opposition inside the Senate to the JCPOA. I suspect there were a couple of other votes that would have gone that way as well if the administration had actually gone to a vote. So I think now, having said that, and to be fair to the Obama administration, they suspected, I think President Obama suspected, that there was nothing he could do to reach out to a certain number of Republicans. They were just going to oppose it because it was his deal. And the reality is that's true. And I'm afraid to say that one of the things I worry about in a second Trump administration is that a second Trump administration would also squander all of its accomplishments with maximum pressure by agreeing essentially to a warmed over version of the JCPOA and saying that it was the Trump deal and it was the greatest deal ever. I mean, that's essentially what he did with NAFTA. I think you could see this coming, again, same with the China trade deal for that matter. So I think you can see this coming if there's going to be a second, Trump administration. I think, frankly, the prospects for bipartisanship are not great, and that's in part because our political system has become so polarized, although it's more polarization of political elites than it is the electorate, and I think the electorate may be proving that in this election. We'll see, of course. I think some of the prospects for bipartisanship will depend a little bit on how deep the defeat for Trump and Trumpism is, if in fact he is defeated. And one of the reasons why I'm hoping for overwhelming repudiation of the president at the polls is precisely because I think it will help get the Republican Party back onto a saner track in terms of bipartisanship. I think one thing that a Biden administration could do to help would be to say at the outset that it intends to submit whatever agreement it reaches with Iran. And I agree with Bob. I hope that the vice president doesn't rush back into it for the reasons Bob said, but for others as well. I think they've got a lot of leverage. I don't think they want to squander it. The situation's very different from what it was a year ago. You can't kind of unring the bell here and just walk back into it, in my view. And I think they'll face problems inside the Senate with their own caucus if they do. So I hope that, cooler heads prevail. But I think if the Biden administration said whatever agreement it comes to with Iran, it'll submit to the Congress for a vote along the lines of the SALT agreement of 1972. Which is what the Nixon administration did. I think it would go
and didn't require 2/3 of the Senate. It was an executive it required a simple majority in both in both houses.
Right. But I mean, I think if they did that, they would actually submit it to a vote, a majority vote. I think that would go a long way to help build some bipartisanship.
I would just add on this. I think this is one of the tragedies in U.S. foreign policy in recent years, how the Middle East and in general and U.S. policy toward the Middle East has become a partisan issue. And I think it's broader than the JCPOA. And I think there's the risk that support for Israel and support for traditional partners in the region like UAE, the Gulf states, is seen somehow as a partisan issue now that's something that Republicans do, but not others. But I do think it started in part from the Iran deal. And I thought the Obama approach to the Iran deal was quite good, actually. I was a supporter of the approach to Iran from the beginning and until about 2015 or so. And I think the problem, in my view, is that the Obama administration stopped too short, that we could have pushed for harder terms. And we gave Iran too good of a deal. I think there are some Republicans who would have thought that any deal with Iran is unacceptable. We can't trust them. My concern was really about enrichment. The United States has worked to stop the spread of enrichment reprocessing to all countries, even our allies, for many years. We don't allow South Korea to reprocess. We got UAE to sign up to this gold standard of no enrichment reprocessing. And then we say, okay, we're going to have an international agreement where we give Iran, basically an enemy, the world's largest state sponsor of terror, the ability to enrich uranium. So we trust the clerics in Iran with this, but not our democratic allies in South Korea. And I think that was a mistake. And I think it was the right move for the Trump administration to say that our goal is zero enrichment. So in terms of regaining bipartisanship, I think it could be hard. I think one thing Biden administration could do is say, okay, we're in a different place now than we were in 2015. We have, whether we like the Trump approach or not, we have new leverage now. The sanctions, I think, have been more successful than many people predicted. Many people predicted that unilateral U.S. sanctions weren't going to have much of an effect. I think we've seen they've had an effect. So I think that the Biden administration would push for tougher terms than what they achieved in the JCPOA. That may be one thing that could get more Republicans on board.
Thanks, Matt. I'd like to take two of the questions that we've received from the audience and put them out there to our panelists and ask each of them to address either question or any other aspect of our conversation today in a few minutes of brief closing remarks. The first question comes from Greg Thielman at the Arms Control Association, who asks, what role does U.S. strategic missile defenses play in deterring Iran and North Korea? And then let me also pose a question from Maya Tanaka with Japan's Kyoto News, who's questioned the Trump administration's approach on North Korea's short-range missiles, which have remained a threat for neighboring countries such as Japan, wondering whether either a Biden administration or presumably a Trump 2.0 might take a tougher stance on any test firing of missiles, including short-range missiles. Jung, if I could ask you to start with either one of those questions, or if you'd like to make any other points on the question of bipartisanship or future diplomacy.
Thanks. One of the reasons I mentioned that North Korea might do a strategic test or demonstration or threaten to do it, even with the Trump, with the second Trump administration, is that because the Trump administration so far has ignored those short-range ballistic missiles, despite the concerns of our allies, Japan and South Korea. So I think that might be a way of trying to get the president's attention in a second administration to try to jumpstart something on North Korea's terms, based on North Korea's unease with its dependence on China. So I think that when we are talking about what to do next, is that it's not so much what we can predict. This is not the lottery, for example. We're not in the business of predicting what numbers are going to be the winning numbers, but how do we manage the unknown, the ambiguous? And I think we have to be ready for all sorts of things, whether it's a short-range ballistic missile test or a strategic demonstration, and to make sure that we have all those things in place. My concern with the demonstration, a ballistic missile test early on in the next administration is that, again, we'll be flat-footed. And it's that we'll be responding versus acting, that we'll be scrambling for a response versus having, you know, even as maybe a new administration might be going through a policy review, that North Korea is probably not going to allow the next administration to have that option. So I think we have to be prepared and ready to respond and to act and to try to change the dynamics. But you know, North Korea has a vote here, and it has a really big vote.
Great. I'll just turn next to Matt in the order that I have you on my screen here.
Okay, wonderful. Well, I guess I'll address the question on missile defense, and I do think that missile defense plays an important role for Iran and North Korea, both theater missile defenses to protect U.S. allies and bases in the region, but also the homeland missile defense system. And North Korea either has an ICBM or is on the verge of having an ICBM, making it only the, you know, some people say, well, what, you know, a lot of countries have nuclear weapons. Why are we so concerned? But North Korea would become only the third U.S. adversary after Russia and China to have the ability to threaten nuclear war against the U.S. homeland. So this is an important threat, and having the ability to defend against that is important. If you look at the 2018 Nuclear Posture Review, it says that we don't have a policy of mutual vulnerability with North Korea like we might with Russia or China, that it's an escalation dominance strategy. That we want to protect ourselves and be able to threaten the end of the Kim regime for any strategic attack. So I think continuing to develop our homeland missile defenses to keep pace with the North Korea threat is important. And as Ambassador Edelman pointed out, as the North Korean arsenal continues to grow, that is going to place upward demands on what we need in terms of homeland defense. I think this is an important part of our deterrence and defense strategy.
Thanks so much, Matt. Ambassador Edelman, over to you.
Well, let me just add one thing in answer to Greg's question to what Matt just said, which is more specifically, I think we always face the danger of a conflict breaking out on the Korean Peninsula, a conventional conflict. But the missile defense becomes a deterrent to North Korea using its nuclear weapons in a situation where they're facing a catastrophic conventional defeat, which might actually get them to use their nuclear weapons. I think the missile defense piece of this is important. And it's something that's been recognized going back to the Clinton administration, which first began raising the issue of a potential, what they called national missile defense to deal with a rogue actor, which was aimed at North Korea. So I think there's been bipartisan support for this going back some ways.
And finally to you, Bob.
Thank you, Suzanne. You know, quickly on the short-range missile threat to our North Korean missile threat to our allies. I think the Trump administration has concentrated too much on dealing with the long-range missile threat, the threat to the American homeland, and that has upset our Japanese and South Korean allies, as Jung has pointed out. In an interim agreement with the North, which is the kind of agreement I would support as a step toward denuclearization, I would call for a ban not only on the testing of ICBM range missiles, but all missiles down to very tactical battlefield missiles. The North already has these missiles. I don't think they're going to give them up, but I think constraining the testing would reduce the reliability of the systems, their ability to penetrate local defenses and so forth. So I would advocate that. Now, Greg Thielman's question dealt with the impact of U.S. Strategic defenses on deterrence. So let me focus on our homeland defenses. The policy, not just of the Trump administration, but Obama and Bush before him, has been deterrence by denial. In other words, trying to prevent North Korea from having the ability to attack the U.S. homeland with nuclear weapons. And so we were designing and sizing our homeland missile defense capability to get ahead of the North Korean threat, to be able to deny them that ability. Unfortunately, what's happening is the North Koreans have made real strides with their long-range missile capabilities. We saw in the October 10 parade, that's a missile. It probably can carry multiple independently targetable reentry vehicles yet, but it probably has the payload to deliver a multiple warhead payload to the United States and penetration aids and decoys. And it's clear that the North Koreans are going to do everything they can to ensure they have a reliable ability to attack the United States homeland. So look, we can try with directed energy, with space, you know, all kinds of exotic technologies to stay ahead of the game. But I think at the end of the day, unfortunately, we're going to have a situation where we will rely on the threat of retaliation with U.S. offensive strategic forces to deter the North Korean nuclear attack. It's unfortunate, but sooner or later, that's the world we're going to have to live in.
Thanks so much, Bob. And thanks to all of our panelists, Ambassador Edelman, Matt, and Jungkook. This has just been a fascinating discussion. And what I'm so really pleased about is that we've been able to hear from a variety of different perspectives, from a variety of different scenarios involving two of the most urgent threats that we'll be facing the next president. I really want to commend everyone and ask our audience to join us in a round of virtual applause for this terrific group of experts. And I hope we can reconvene you back sometime after January when we will have an opportunity to talk about who is actually in the White House and how they are going to be approaching these challenges and others. Thanks so much and look forward to seeing you all soon.